listening to Telling Tales with Ms. G. And I have a short story tonight that is kind of sort of apropos of, well, the fact that it was Martin Luther King Day on the 19th, and we've just had the President's State of the Union Address. It's titled The Evicted. It's by Fred Travis. And it's from Reporting Civil Rights, American Journalism, 1941 to 1973. So I'll give you a moment to get settled, and I'll be right back. Please stay tuned. And this is Ms. G, bringing you Telling Tales here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Tonight's story, titled The Evicted, is by Fred Travis, Reporting Civil Rights, American Journalism, from 1941 to 73. In 1960, John Doerr, a newly appointed Assistant Attorney General for the U.S. Civil Rights Division in the Eisenhower administration, struggled to convince the FBI to investigate reports that white landowners and business proprietors had been evicting and otherwise punishing black sharecroppers who registered to vote in two western Tennessee counties of Fayette and Haywood. Although the populations for both counties were heavily African-American, virtually all registered voters were white. In Fayette County alone, only 58 of the approximately 9,000 eligible black voters had been allowed to register to vote by 1959. And a registration campaign refereed by the federal government in the summer of 1960 met with stiff opposition by white officials. Yet J. Edgar Hoover initially rebuffed the request to investigate the matter. Fed up with the FBI's recalcitrance, Doerr went to Tennessee himself, collecting 50 affidavits from black sharecroppers who had kept their eviction notices and tracking down white residents who were disturbed by what was happening and were willing to testify. According to Branch, the conspirators had gone so far as to obtain legal opinions for how best to prevent Negro registration without getting caught in federal violations. As a result of his field work, Doerr was able to add several dozen defendants to the federal lawsuit against those who participated in the campaign to prohibit black citizens from voting. In the end, over 70 landowners were named in each of the two suits filed in Haywood and Fayette counties. Fred Travis, a reporter for the Chattanooga Times, had been following the story, and he visited the area to learn what was happening to the families who had been evicted. Shepherd Towles, a black landowner, had permitted them to live in tents on his property, but the strain on his water supply caused the well to run dry. Gertrude Beasley, another nearby black landowner, took in some of the families to relieve the burden on Towles' resources. At one point, over a dozen extended families, including 100 children, lived in what became known as Tent City, some staying for nearly 2 years. Travis's report, The Evicted, appeared in the February 1961 issue of the Progressive. The case brought by the Civil Rights Division worked its way through the courts, and the outcome was bittersweet. The Haywood County lawsuit was settled out of court in May 1962. And the Fayette County suit was resolved 2 months later. When the federal district court issued a consent decree, in both cases, the white defendants agreed to cease their attempts to engage in any acts for the purpose of interfering with the right of any person to register to vote and to vote for candidates for public office. Yet none of the evicted tenants regained their leases. Similarly, none of the defendants paid court costs or fines for the transgressions, and the decision in Fayette County was handed down without constituting evidence of admission with respect to the issues of fact. All other pending lawsuits against the officials and landowners were dismissed. No person, whether acting under color of law or otherwise, shall intimidate, coerce, or attempt to intimidate, threaten, or coerce any other person for the purpose of interfering with the right of such other person to vote or to vote as he may choose for, or not to vote for, any candidate for the office of president, vice president, presidential elector, member of the Senate, or member of the House of Representatives, delegates or commissioners from the territories or possessions, at any general, special, or primary election held solely or in part for the purpose of selecting or electing any such candidate. This is from the Civil Rights Act of 1957, federal statutes. Mrs. Georgia May Turner grubbed at a shallow trench with a cotton hoe trying to drain a puddle of water in front of her tent in a camp called Freedom Village, 3 miles south of Somerville, Tennessee. The 58-year-old widow and three of her five children were among a growing number of Negroes being forced off the land because they registered and voted in Fayette County, where Negroes outnumber whites by more than 2-1. "I've been on that farm for 38 years," Mrs. Turner said, pausing to wipe from her face the cold rain that beat down incessantly. "I worked for Mr. McNamee, and when he died, I stayed on and worked for his widow. I always done what that woman say. I never disobey my boss lady, and I ain't holding nothing against her now. I'll let the Lord settle with her." "I work shares," Mrs. Turner continued. "Sometimes Mrs. McNamee say I owe her as much as $4,000 or $5,000, and I work it all off. I don't owe her nothing when I left. In good years, I sometimes used to make $50 or $100. I don't know. She always keeps the counts. Last summer, I went down to Somerville and registered to vote, and she say she seen my picture in the paper. She say, I got your picture. And I don't know what she mean at first. Then she tell me last fall I got to get off her farm. She say she don't want me there no more. I say, I get off at the end of the year. Now this tent my home, but it almost as good as that house I had. I registered to vote in September, said William Trotter, who moved into the tent camp with his wife and six children. In October, my landlord came down to the cotton field and say, Willie, you'll have to get out. I'm going to fix up the house. These are some of the results of the federal government's first attempt to enforce the right of Negroes to vote in Deep South counties, where they outnumber the white man, but are heavily dependent upon him for economic survival. On the outcome of this effort will hinge the chances for Negroes in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina to participate freely in future elections, and perhaps determine the course of new civil rights legislation in Congress. For the Fayette and Haywood County cases in Tennessee have produced a conflict between the Negroes' civil rights and the white man's property rights, which ultimately must be resolved by the United States Supreme Court. Before that happens, however, there may be an explosion of racial violence more intense than any the South has experienced in the desegregation of public schools. Emotions are running high on both sides, with threats and accusations and even occasional gunfire being exchanged. If the government's case fails, more than 700 Negro families may be ordered out of the farm tenant and sharecropper shacks, which have been their only homes most of their lives. Ignorant and unskilled, they are incapable of earning a living except by raising cotton, corn, and soybeans, and maybe a few chickens and hogs. Negroes work the land under many arrangements. A few tenants lease the land and work it with their own equipment, but most are sharecroppers and are furnished a house, food, equipment, seed, fertilizer, medicine, and other supplies on credit. When the harvest is in, the sharecropper's part is usually about a half to a third of the crop, out of which he must pay for items advanced him. The net profit on the 5 to 20 acre plots may range from $50 to $300 a year. Though it is just as liable to turn out to be a loss of that much or more. Fayette and Haywood counties, 30 miles east of Memphis in the West Tennessee cotton country, are part of the Old South. Their broad fields stretch on each side of the Nashville to Memphis highways, and sharecropper and tenant shacks stand out against the flatlands. Aside from the few sawmills, cotton gins, and soybean oil mills, there is practically no industry. Fayette County on the Mississippi state border has 24,577 residents, but the number has been dropping steadily since 1940 as both whites and Negroes seek opportunities elsewhere. 70% of the population is Negro, and they own about 10% of the land. The white people were so exercised over the Democratic Party's civil rights position that they voted for the state's rights ticket in 1948 and 56, and in 1960 voted Republican for the first time. Before last August, a few Negroes had been permitted to vote in federal and state elections, but they always were excluded from the county Democratic primary in which local officials are named. The county primary, financed by qualifying fees imposed upon the candidates and without sanction in state law, is regarded as a private affair for the white people, though the nominations are equivalent to election to local offices. Haywood County to the north has a population of 23,393, of which 60% is Negro. Until last August, no Negro had ever voted in that county unless he did so during the Reconstruction. The policy in these two counties was in sharp contrast to most of Tennessee, which is a border state and has adopted generally what is by Southern standards a moderate policy in handling racial problems. Negroes long have been permitted to vote in other counties and are even encouraged to do so by politicians in the metropolitan areas. Voting qualifications have been so lax that Negroes in some cities were not even required to be alive to have their names on the registration books. Trouble started in Haywood and Fayette counties in 1959 when the Negroes, with some outside help, organized civic and welfare leagues. Groups of them went to the old courthouse in the middle of the Brownsville Public Square to register, but found the Haywood County Election Commission had just resigned. In Fayette County, when Negroes began showing up in groups at the Election Commission office, they were told they could not register. The federal government's Commission on Civil Rights sent in agents to investigate, and the federal district court at Memphis issued an injunction prohibiting local officials from blocking the registrations. As long as just a few of us were registered and voted, the white folks didn't pay no attention to us, said Scott Franklin, who runs a little store in the Moscow community down near the Mississippi line. He is president of the Fayette County Civic and Welfare League. After we got out this injunction, I heard some white people say, "We can beat them." Then we didn't know what it was. Now we know they was going to run us out of the county. Franklin and other Negro merchants, like John McFerrin, who runs a pint-sized supermarket just outside Somerville, the seat of Fayette County, were among the first to feel the economic pressure. Their credit and deliveries from local wholesalers were cut off. An oil distributor removed the gas line pumps from in front of Franklin's store. Salesmen for distributors in Memphis and Jackson, Tennessee, said they would have to stop supplying the Negro merchants or lose their white customers. What little the Negroes could get to sell, they had to haul from Memphis. When Negroes went into white stores to make purchases, the clerks checked their names against lists of registered voters or welfare league members before making the sale. Credit and even gasoline for farm tractors were refused those who had registered. As word of the Negroes' plight spread, assistance arrived in the form of food packages from Memphis, Nashville, New York, Chicago, and other cities. Roy Wilkins, chairman of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, reported the situation to the Democratic Platform Committee at Los Angeles a few days before the party's nominating convention opened last July. "Today, as we talk here," he said, "Negro farmers in Fayette County who persisted and finally registered to vote are being refused gasoline for their tractors, trucks, and other farm machinery. Distributors of four nationally known oil companies have joined in this punishment of men who sought merely to exercise their American right to vote. Negro leaders in the registration drive, he continued, had been blacklisted by local merchants and cannot buy food and clothing. I trust the Justice Department will do something about this, he added. Meanwhile, people cannot eat and cannot make their crops. Agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation joined those of the Civil Rights Commission in an investigation. They reported merchants checking lists of Negroes who had registered or were members of the welfare leagues and refusing sales to them. James A. Kurtz, a clerk in the economy store in Brownsville, was quoted by an FBI agent as having said he was told by the store owners not to extend credit to names that appear on a list of members of the Haywood County Civic and Welfare League. Notice of tenant lease and sharecropper contract termination began shortly after Tennessee's August Democratic primary to nominate federal and state officials. Negroes voted in the primary in both counties, and some of them claim lists of names were compiled at the polls for use in the campaign for economic retaliation. Others registered later in preparation for the November general election and found their names were added to the lists. Last December, the Justice Department went into the federal court in Memphis and asked a temporary injunction restraining landowners from evicting Negroes who had registered. John Doerr, the government attorney, called the planned evictions the most cruel step people could take against citizens of this country in telling them to get off the land. The United States government says this is wrong. Nine of the white defendants called by the government as witnesses clammed up, claiming Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. An exception was one white woman, Mrs. Esther Green, who testified she had refused to sign a petition pledging economic action against Negroes who registered. She explained, "I think for myself." She recalled a 1959 visit by Shelby Dixon, a cotton ginner in the Stanton community, to her farm way up in the hills in Haywood County. Dixon, she said, asked her to sign a promise not to help any member of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the Haywood County Civic and Welfare League, or anyone else that the Central Committee does not approve of. "That was too broad," Mrs. Green said. "I told him it didn't sound right to me and I didn't want to sign." Isaac Smith Carter, a white tenant on another farm, testified his landlord had refused to have anything to do with him after he refused to join in the campaign to hamper Negro registration. The defense denied that Negroes were being evicted in reprisal for voting and insisted that the dismissals resulted from the inefficiency of tenants and machination of farming. One landowner, Montezuma Carter Jr., said he was shifting to machines and had no earthly need for the 10 Negro tenant families on his property. Federal Judge Marion S. Boyd of Memphis refused to grant the government's request to halt the evictions. The Civil Rights Act is intended to protect the right to register and vote and provide injunctive relief against such interference and coercion, he said. "That's all it does. I don't believe this court has any right to enjoin the evictions or enjoin the altering of leases." A few days later, he was overruled by the Sixth United States Circuit Court of Appeals, which held that the Negroes could not be evicted as an interference with their right to vote. The appeals court left it to Judge Boyd to decide how its findings should be enforced. Boyd then told landlords they could not evict Negro tenants without proving in his court that the eviction was not an attempt to interfere with the Negro's voting rights. Boyd's decision places a burden of proof on the landlord, but it also leaves the door open for evictions in connection with a normal rearrangement of agricultural practices. The action of the courts to date has been a temporary holding action aimed at maintaining the status quo while the issue is being litigated. Further hearings were ordered before a final decision, and there is no doubt the case ultimately will reach the United States Supreme Court. Meanwhile, bitterness hangs heavily over the land. The tent camp set up on the 200-acre farm of Shepherd Towles one of the few Negroes with substantial land holdings in the area, was denounced by whites as a publicity stunt to attract sympathy and relief for the Negroes. "It's just a propaganda stunt," declared Mayor I.P. Yancey of Somerville. "I don't know of any need around here." White landowners and businessmen, on the advice of their lawyers, who include practically the entire bar associations of both counties, declined to discuss the situation with strangers. "Don't quote me and don't mention my name," said one farmer. "I'm a defendant in that federal court case. We defendants refer to ourselves as the honor roll and laugh about it, but it's a mighty dry laugh, I'll tell you. Those Negroes go down there to those government lawyers and swear out those false affidavits. Of course they're all lies, but you've got to hire yourself a lawyer and defend yourself just the same. It's mostly the work of some of those northern agitators. They came down here and got the Negroes all stirred up and told them they ought to go register and vote," he continued. "We've known this was coming for a long time, and we've been trying to reduce our population of Negroes. Of course, we are mechanizing our farms. We've got to stay in business. Why, we've got 60 or 70 mechanical cotton pickers in the county already, and each one of them can do the work of 75 of them. We got plenty of corn picking machines, and a lot of farmers are turning to raising livestock. You don't need many farmhands for livestock." He cited the national trend toward mechanized farming and the consolidation of farms into bigger units. In the 1,223 square miles of Fayette and Haywood counties, the number of farm units dropped by 1,815 between 1954 and 1959, and the number of farm tenants declined by 1,586. "We just don't have any need for so many Negroes anymore," said another landowner, who was equally emphatic in his demands for anonymity. "I'm not a defendant in one of those federal court cases yet, and I don't want to be. I'm trying to get them off my land before they enjoin me. I'm going to machines." The whites called attention to the fact that Negroes have declined tenant and sharecropper offers from Arkansas and other Tennessee counties where their race is a minority and farmhands are badly needed. The Somerville Weekly newspaper, the Fayette County Falcon, carried a number of advertisements offering places in Phillips County, Arkansas, and Lauderdale County, Tennessee. But the Negroes were deeply suspicious of the offer, seeing them as a further part of the campaign to get them out of the county so the white man can remain firmly in control of the ballot box. "Man come out here and say he want 10 tenant families for his farm somewhere over about Nashville," said Mrs. Turner. "He say he got 80 acres of land. What he gonna do with 10 tenant families on a farm no bigger than that?" John McFerrin, who was busy directing the operation of Freedom Village, said, "The sheriff told us we could go to other counties without being shot at and intimidated. A landowner over in Lauderdale County say he want 2 families to work for wages, but he won't say how much wages." McFerrin, whose supermarket is plastered inside with signs like, "Please don't discuss politics in here unless you are registered to vote," reported he had checked out 2 of the job offers and rejected them. They couldn't answer details on assurances of making a living on the farms, he said. He disputed the claim that the machine could replace the Negro and predicted that a lot of landowners would go broke trying to use machines on the small, sometimes hilly farms. White's claim McFerrin has found a profitable operation in handling the relief packages for the displaced tenants, but the Negro leader denies this. When a shot was fired into the tent city, wounding slightly a Negro man sleeping there with his wife and 4 children, McFerrin said, "I expected they'd try to get me, but I didn't think they would shoot into the tents while people were asleep in them." He warned of possible further violence. "The white people started the shooting. I'm a nonviolence man myself, but I can't always control my people. Some of these people are getting pretty desperate." "We need government help to get relief from this pressure," he continued, "and we need relief from this boycott the white folks have put on us. We need medical help, too. We don't have a Negro doctor in this county, and the Negroes can't get any help from the white clinics. We have to go to Memphis to get a doctor, and that's nearly 40 miles away." McPheron declined to identify the organizations which are providing assistance in the form of food, clothing, and money. He said he was afraid he might omit one from the list and offend someone. One organization which has contributed substantially is the Southern Conference Education Fund, a favorite target of Mississippi Senator James Eastland, who likes to call it a leftist organization or worse. This is just a sample of what is going to happen in Mississippi when the Negroes try to vote down there, said the Reverend Kelly Miller Smith of Nashville, a leader in the Reverend Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference. If we don't win the fight for the vote in Fayette County, we won't have a chance in other areas of the South. If the government wins its fight, the Negroes may get the right to free use of the ballot in Fayette and Haywood counties, but there may not be many of them around to enjoy it. Meanwhile, conditions in the West Tennessee cotton country are likely to get a lot worse before there is any improvement. That's The Evicted by Fred Travis from 1961 out of The Progressive. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I will be right back. Please stay tuned. Hello, this is Ms. G, bringing you Telling Tales, still here at 104.3 in Juneau. I hope you enjoyed and got something from that last story, The Evicted. And now I have a poem out of a collection of poems from the Kwushkanidie artists, Songs That Shake the Earth, out of their poetry book, Volume 2. It's by Robert Stevenson. A Tribe of One. Although I fit the profile, I do not fit the part. I'm a technicolor exile, finished from the start. I tried to be just like you, tried not to be like me. I wanted to belong here, but I know it just can't be. Arrested by the networks, framed by the TV news, born to be a suspect, or just born to lose. I'm always undercover and always on the run. Chased by fear and loathing, I am a tribe of one. My tribe declines to have me unwelcome in my clan. Can't be black, can't be white, can't find my place to stand. Accused of not belonging, my heart has turned to stone. Sentenced to remain separate, condemned to stand alone. The ghosts of hope and solace come to take me by the hand. They whisper secret words of meaning that I can't understand, for I cannot speak my language. I cannot name my son, and even though I have a name, I am a tribe of one. Is it my fault that I don't fit the box you put me in? Is it my fault that I don't think that being black's a sin? I want to feel the freedom, but never have to roam to find the place where I belong. I want to come home. My race, my creed, my color, by the culture that I've lost, by grisly scars and unshed tears, I try to count the cost. Forgive them, Father, for their sins. They know not what they've done. Forgive me, Mother, for my shame. I am a tribe of one. There are so many broken branches in my family tree, so many empty spaces where faces ought to be. From this prison built of stone, through bars encased in rust, I see the standard of my people laying in the dust. As my child picks up the banner, I take his hand in mine. As one, we walk to freedom across that color line. like our ancestors before us, like a father, like a son, like ambassadors of freedom. We are a tribe of one. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G. Until next time, good night.